A room without windows, a room without doors, a room where no guy but I can spy the charms that are yours. Like being marooned on an island far from civilized shores. You and me in a room without windows, a room without doors. No bells will be ringing, no telephone calls. In our little, well-secluded cell of ceiling and walls, while dozens of males sit and chew their nails and hate me because I am yours in a room without windows, a room without doors. If they said, friend, how...
Hello and welcome to Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway for Sunday, March 10th, 2024. My name is James Marino, and in the broadcast today we have Peter Felicia and Michael Portantier. Peter is a playwright, journalist, and historian with a number of books. His new book, Brain Teasers for Broadway Geniuses, is now available wherever finer books are sold. Peter also has columns at Masterworks Broadway, Broadway Select, and many other places. Hello, Peter.
Hi.
Peter, we did not give you your due. Last week, you and I pre-recorded our trivia because you were away last week. First of all, where were you last week?
I was in Hillsboro, Missouri, seeing A Case of Libel, a 1963 play that was tremendously done by director Rebecca Ellison, who it's Jefferson College, which is 60 years old. So what they were doing is plays from the 63-64 season, which I know well from my book, The Great Parade, which details that season. So they did Barefoot in the Park in the fall, and here they are doing A Case of Libel, a very, very obscure play that was done that season. It ran a while. It ran over 200 performances that season. But you know me, I'm interested in seeing shows I haven't seen before from way back when. So that was enough to get me out to Hillsboro, Missouri, having a wonderful time.
Oh, great to hear. But last week was the big announcement that Theater World Awards are going to honor you for all of your years of great support for this organization.
Yeah, I guess I can hold a job, huh? I tell you, it's hard to believe it's been 25 years, but figures don't lie. So, yes, indeed. And God love them for recognizing that and caring. I appreciate.
Well, I'm very concerned for you, and perhaps we'll be able to finally see if there are actually two Peter Felicias, because both the Drama Desk Awards and the Theater World Awards are on June 10th. So I was thinking maybe you could, by magnanimous consent, combine the two awards into one place, you know? So the Drama Desk Theater World Awards, you know? Is that something you can get done?
I'll work my magic and we'll see what happens.
All right. Also with us this week is Michael Portantier. Michael's a theater reviewer and essayist. He's the founder and editor of castalbumreviews.com. He is also a theatrical photographer whose photos have appeared in the New York Times and other major publications. You could see his photography work at followspotphoto.com. Hello, Michael.
Hello.
And Michael, this week passed, a couple of days ago, we had your show at 54 Below, your cast album show. So how did it go? You were losing your voice last week. Did it come back in time?
It was a miracle. As of still the morning of the show, I had so much phlegm. I didn't feel sick other than that, but just phlegm. So I was asking everyone I knew, for recommendations, and people said tea with lemon and honey, which I knew, but then someone said, you know what you should absolutely do is eat some potato chips. I said what That's what I said. And they said, yes, the oil in the potato chips soaks up the phlegm. So I said, all right, I'll give it a try. And I went and bought some potato chips, and then I went to the rehearsal the tech run through, and before I opened the bag, I went to ask some of the other performers. I said, you know, George says that if I eat potato chips, that'll help my phlegm. And they were all like, oh, sure, everybody knows that.
Wow. No, nobody knows that. That's
well,
great.
Apparently some of them do. And it, I mean, I can't say for sure if that's what did it, but the phlegm cleared up enough for me to be able to sing a few songs. And then, oddly enough, it sort of came back the next day.
Wow.
So, yeah. So it does seem like, well, you know, it makes sense if you think about the explanation. So,
wow, this is the best cure I've heard since they said you have to eat ice cream after your tonsils are removed.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I love potato chips. But anyway, back to the show. It went really well. We were discussing last night. I saw another show at 54 Below, Scott Siegel's 54 Sings Broadway's Greatest Hits. And they're all enjoyable, but there are some nights where everything just seems to click, where the energy of the different performers seems to click, and the mix of songs that are chosen on a particular night seem to really make the audience very, very happy. And that was the case with, I think, with my show and with Scott's show last night. So I was very, very pleased with how it turned out.
That's great. I saw a great photograph of everybody in the show posted on your Facebook page. I'll throw that in the show notes so you can see this amazing cast that you put together for this. And we'll be looking forward to part three. Because
yes.
They keep making cast albums. It's like Dunkin' Donuts. We'll keep making them or whatever they say.
Well, as I mentioned in the show, of course, there was a hiatus with the pandemic where we were all just sitting around and trying to decide what to do with ourselves. There were some virtual concerts and things that happened that helped people pass the time, but no new cast albums during that period. But now... it's like the floodgates have opened and there's so many.
That's a good thing.
We liked having Robbie Rozelle in our show because he is the A&R director for Center Stage Records after having done the same for Broadway Records for many years. And before that, he worked for PS Classics. So he really knows the production end of cast albums. But he also sings really well. So he sang She Loves Me, the title song from She Loves Me. But he had some very, very funny stories about having to correct Neil Patrick Harris in one word of lyrics that he had gotten wrong Robbie had to do this while Sondheim was sitting next to him.
Oh,
boy.
Yeah. So talk about pressure, right?
So Robbie was in the studio this week as well with Patti LuPone. Do we know any details? I don't know what they were recording. Maybe
it's
missed it.
It's her new show, and I can't. I don't have the title at the moment.
Do you mean what she's doing at Carnegie Hall?
Yes. Uh-huh. Whatever the title of that is. Let's see if we can find it.
All right. So it's very exciting. We have to make a correction for last week or the week before. Cole Escola, we're using the wrong pronouns. Cole goes by they and them. I apologize for us making this mistake repeatedly. We should have fixed that earlier. So thanks so much.
Patti's album, it's called Patti LuPone: A Life in Notes.
Huh. All right. Cheryl Hodges-Selton is in our chat room, and she says she's seeing Patti in Boston April 2nd. Cheryl, you do get around.
Yeah, I'll say.
Covering the whole East Coast here. Wow. and Michigan. You know, you have to tell us about your Michigan shows, Cheryl. All right. Other things to mention is that in our regular public Broadway radio feed, Jan Simpson's All the Drama, the latest one, Next to Normal, is out in the public feed. The Patreon listeners got it a week earlier. And so you can check that out then. So first up, Peter, you got down to the Public Theater to see The Ally. So tell us about this.
Well, a very conventional way of giving praise is saying, if you like X, you'll love Y. And I'm going to do it twice today. And this is the first one, because if you liked Prayer for the French Republic, you're going to very much appreciate The Ally by Itamar Moses, who has certainly made a name for himself, both in the play world and the musical world, because he did The Band's Visit as well. So this is a very, very smart and powerful play, and it does deal with Jewish issues, as does Prayer for the French Republic. What's so skillful about it is we have a man who is trying the best he can to be the best possible person he can be. And the famous expression that you hear from time to time, that no good deed goes unpunished, is certainly something that is relevant to what's going on here. Because here he is teaching, and not even a well-paid teacher, and well, I guess that goes without saying. But more to the point, it's a situation where he's an adjunct professor. He doesn't teach that much. But anyway, two students approach him and ask him to sign a petition. And while there's a detail in the petition that he really isn't in favor of, fine, so much of it is so right that that indeed, let's do it. So he signs the petition, and what a maelstrom, because indeed other people come forward, other students come forward saying you did the wrong thing, you're causing a great deal of trouble, so on and so on. And his life just spirals out of control. It's just so amazing. And we've all had this experience where you do one thing that infuriates people, and indeed you pay for it for years and years and years. And that's what this is about. And of course, because he's married, he also has a wife who has a million opinions on what he's doing and what he's not doing. And that's really a problem as well, needless to say, because it's not just what happens in the real world. It also it affects what happens to you at home. And so it really is quite a struggle for this poor soul. Very, very well, very, very well acted. And we're not surprised, because Lila Neuberger, is that how it's pronounced?
Neugebauer, I think.
Neugebauer, okay.
I'm not 100% sure, but I think it's Neugebauer.
One of our best directors, no question. She proves it again here. But Josh Radnor, phenomenal as the professor. And but they're all so wonderful. And it's one of those plays where you hear all the time, oh, it's very talky. And you don't mind the talk when the talk is galvanizingly wonderful. And that's what it is here. So I don't know if it'll ever move from the public. I hope it does. Certainly Prayer for the French Republic started off at the Manhattan Theater Club and moved to Broadway. I would wish that this would happen with this play too, because it's one that should be seen by so many other people. But it in under the circumstances, I have to say that it does run until April 7th, which isn't very long from now, I'll grant you. But if you can get down to the Public Theater, I don't think that if you have any type of empathy for situations like this, that you'll be at all disappointed.
Peter, do you happen to know how long that this show has been in development?
No. No idea.
It's interesting because of, what we've seen recently with the presidents of Harvard and University of Pennsylvania. Sort of ripped from the headlines type of thing happening here. But and with Itamar Moses and Josh Radnor, very, very popular television actor from How I Met Your Mother, and Lila Neugebauer, I mean, certainly... Yeah. It seems like it has A-list names that it could find the financing to move, although real estate is incredibly tight on Broadway right now.
Sure.
So we'll have to see what happens. All right. So as Peter said, it's running through April 7th, and I'll have a link to that in the show notes. Michael, you headed over to 54 Below when you weren't there for your own show to see 54 Sings Broadway's Greatest Hits, another Scott Siegel joint. So tell us about this.
Yes, as I mentioned before, it was last night. It was really one of the very best. And it was the 129th edition of that particular show, Broadway 54 Sings Broadway's Greatest Hits.
He's done 129.
Yeah.
That's
of that show alone. Yeah. One highlight after another. He had back this, phenomenal, unique, trio, called Moipei, M-O-I-P-E-I, three, sisters from Kenya who are all tall and beautiful and gorgeous and have the most magnificent vocal blend you've ever heard in your life. And so anything they sing becomes a special event. What they chose to sing on this occasion, their first number was I Feel Pretty, with one of them taking the lead of Maria and the other two as her friends, who are kind of kibitzing about her situation. So that was great. And not only their singing, by the way, but their acting. I don't think I had seen them do a light comic number before, Moipei, but they did here, and it was very, very funny. They obviously have the comic chops as well. And then their other number was Sunday, from Sunday in the Park with George. Just incredibly gorgeous harmonies flying through the air at 54 Below. Really, really a very special place. But there were so many other people. Tyler McCall, this 24-year-old young man, did Why God from Miss Saigon, which I don't even like that show, but he but he persuaded me. He sang it so beautifully. I think that is maybe the best song in that show. So at least he has good taste in that sense. And then Tyler and Ryan Knowles did You've Lost That Lovin' Feelin', which, as we mentioned before, you know, Scott recognizes that songs, pop songs, have become part of Broadway, having been featured in jukebox musicals, et cetera. So, you know, so it gives an opportunity for these singers to show their stuff in a different style. And the audience certainly loved that piece. So that was really amazing. And then Luke Hawkins, who started out as a dancer and now has been doing more and more singing, but usually now whenever he does a number, he does both. So he did Kansas City from Oklahoma and A Spoonful of Sugar from Mary Poppins. I had seen him play Bert in Mary Poppins at the Engelmann Theater, but I guess he had his eye on one of the other numbers, so he did it last night. And then Ben Jones did it quite a contrast of numbers and absolutely killed with both of them. The first one was You'll Be Back from Hamilton, which I had actually seen him do it before, and he did it fine. But again, there was something in the air last night, the way the audience was responding. Everyone was just loving it. And he did a whole section, Ben did, where he was flirting with a woman sitting ringside, and she was loving it, and her boyfriend was loving it. And it just, and the audience thought it was hilarious. So that brought the number to a whole nother level of fabulous. And so then at the end, Ben did a complete turnaround, and he sang the most moving and gorgeous version of Bring Him Home that one could ever imagine. Bring Him Home from Les Miserables. So that's it. And then there were several other talented people as well. It was a really, really, really great evening.
All right. So that is 54 Sings Broadway's Greatest Hits. Michael saw it last night, March 9th, but there's a number of other upcoming shows with different songs and different casts coming up. Just the next four, March 23rd, April 1st, April 6th, April 20th. We'll have a link to it in the show notes so you can get over there and pick up your tickets for 54 Sings Broadway's Greatest Hits for whatever fits your schedule. Peter, you headed over to Theater 555 to see the conveniently named show 5. So tell us about it.
Well, here's another example of if you liked X, you'll like Y. Because if you like 6, I dare say you will like 5. Because it is a parody musical. That's part of the title, in fact. I'm told because if they didn't do that, they might be in some sort of legal trouble. I'm not sure if they'd be in legal trouble with Donald Trump, or if they'd be in legal trouble with the creators of 6, but nevertheless, they did want to skirt over that issue. So, very well performed. The concept is that here are the 5 women who have been associated with Donald Trump telling their sides of the story. So, terrific performers. Anya Anasia as Ivana. Gabriella Joy Rodriguez is Marla Maples, wife number 2. Jamie Lynn Beatty as Melania, the current wife. Ivanka Trump is played by Hannah Bonnet. That's the daughter, as you well know. Stormy Daniels makes an appearance too, quite a dynamic one too. Gabby Garcia plays that part. So, it's written by 3 people. Shimmy Braun, I'm not sure if that's a man or a woman, or they, them. Moshiel Newman Daphne, and somebody I believe in, Billy Reese. And he's a very young man. He's not even remotely 30, and he's done so much work around town, including a Star Wars parody musical. But I do believe he's a major talent, and I do believe we're going to hear from him now and forever. What is going to happen, I hope, is that he will write an original musical someday, or an adaptation of a musical will do too. But I'd like to see him get away from the parody stuff and really do a genuine musical, because he has immense talent, both as a composer and as a lyricist. I can't really say for sure what he's done here, because of course of the other people, though indeed, he's the composer. And he really knows how to, parody, the 5, musicals that he cites in the show, because we also have, references to Gypsy. There's a reference to Fiddler, and there's a song, that certainly comes into Chicago as well. And I think I heard a little My Fair Lady in there too. But it's very well produced. At Theater 555, which is at 555 West 42nd Street. And I'm not surprised that it's been extended. It's been extended to April 21st. I expect it's going to be extended beyond that, because the audience went crazy for it. And I'm delighted that everybody had such a wonderful time. So, once again, if you like 6, you're certainly going to like 5.
All right. I wonder if we can get them all lined up and go see 9 next.
And don't forget that musical from the 50s, 17. You know, so we got a million of them.
At least 1776.
That's right.
Has there been a musical 8 based on the movie? You know, well, 9 is based on 8, which is
right.
You know,
8.5. Right. Yeah. yeah. Indeed.
There's 9.5 weeks.
That's right. But that's another story, isn't it?
That's a whole nother story. Yeah,
it is.
All right. So next up, Peter, you got to see Brooklyn Laundry at Manhattan Theater Club. So tell us about this.
Well, this is a good intention play by John Patrick Shanley, who's certainly had a good season, because Doubt is happening not far away. Also, Danny and the Deep Blue Sea was done earlier. So, You know, while I'm sitting watching this play, as it comes to its conclusion, I have to say I thought a lot of West Side Story, because I truly believe that if Tony survived, that he and Maria would have had a terrible marriage, because they certainly would have had in-law trouble, given the fact that he killed her brother. So what would have happened if that occurred? Okay. And in this play, people who barely know each other wind up making a tremendous commitment by the end of the play. Yes, what we have here is Danny Zayas, a tremendous actor, giving a wonderful performance as a gentleman who owns three laundries, and we do see one of them. It's certainly Santa Loquasto has been busy with this one, because we assume that a play called Brooklyn Laundry is going to take place solely in the laundry. And when you get to the Manhattan Theater Club and see the set, it looks so solid and so expensive that you say, well, this is where we're going to be all night. Not remotely. Because what happens is Owen, the laundry owner, has a confrontation with Fran. He's lost her laundry, and he's given her a credit. And she comes in with more laundry. And he starts talking, and she's really not interested, but it's not long before he says, let's go out to dinner. And she accepts the invitation. So the next scene takes place in a trailer, because Fran is there with her sister Trish. And the problem is that Trish is severely ill. So there's a scene where she's trying to minister to her sister, whom she loves. They also have an issue with a mother who indeed is quite ill. And there's always that question of who's responsible and who's going to do, in this case, her part to help. Well, that brings us to another set, which is indeed where we see the date that Owen and Fran have in a very pretty restaurant. And then we're taken to Fran's studio apartment, where indeed she is dealing with Susie, her other sister, and they're having a lot of trouble in terms of who's going to take care of the mother. And the problem is that Fran wants to stay around for Owen. She feels that if she tells him she has all these problems too early in the relationship, that indeed he'll dump her. So, and I do understand that. What I don't understand is what happens at the end of the play, any more than I would expect Tony and Maria to be happy. I'm not sure that this couple will be happy, because something dynamic happens that changes the bad news into worse news, far worse news. And while indeed Owen does the right thing, I cannot believe that this couple is going to have very happy sailing. And so I'm somebody who does wonder, what if, after a show ends, what's the next scene? And I don't predict anything good for this scene. Now, it's interesting to me that John Patrick Shanley has an author's note in the playbill that says, I'm inviting the audience to enjoy the generosity and heroism of people who take on big responsibilities without big acclaim. And yes, I do understand that, but I can't be happy for these people in the way that I usually am happy when people get together at the end of a show. I'm worried about their future. I don't believe they're going to have a happy one. And for a while I thought, okay, this must be the point, that indeed some people make hasty decisions that ruin their lives. But again, that playwright's note indicates just the opposite. He really is applauding Owen for taking on a tremendous responsibility, a tremendous responsibility. I don't want to give it away, but I'm telling you, it's beyond what you might expect it to be. And yeah, I just kind of go out feeling satisfied. I have to go out thinking, boy, these people are really in trouble. So, as well as it's performed, because as much as I'm praising Danny Zayas, I also have to applaud Cecily Strong, who some people know as a TV person, as Fran, and Florencio Lozano as Trish, and Andrea Sikorsky as Susie, in a production that is very, very, very well directed by John Patrick Shanley himself. And you certainly get your money worth when you see that set on that turntable that you get so many generous sets that, but wow, yeah, it's just something that I just couldn't tie into.
All right. So that is Brooklyn Laundry at MTC's Manhattan Theater Club, MTC's Off-Broadway showcase at City Center. It's playing through April 14th. We'll have a link to that in the show notes. So, Michael, you got over to the Professional Performing Arts School, or PPAS, in Manhattan to see a production of Titanic. Boy, you are seeing all the Titanics there are to Titanic.
Yes, this was yesterday afternoon. And yes, indeed, this is the third complete production of Titanic that I've seen in the past like 2 weeks, because I had reported on the production that I saw at NYU Steinhardt a few weeks ago. And then yesterday I saw this one. And then sometime in the middle there, I caught up with the video of the recent London production. Have either of you seen that?
Yeah, I have.
No, I haven't.
Yeah, it's quite good, I think.
Quite good, quite good. So, and I did see all of them all the way through. So, I don't know, maybe I should like write a thesis on the show.
Going to go to the Encores?
I'll be going to the Encores, and then I'll be really, really, really well versed in it. I'll probably be able to sing the whole thing at that point, you know. But I love Titanic overall, despite its flaw. It's so interesting. First, let me talk about the show itself one more time. I finally come to the conclusion that the main point I want to make about Titanic is that in the first act, Maury Yeston, who wrote the music and lyrics, and Peter Stone, who wrote the book, did an excellent job of musicalizing the story, the incredible story, incredible but true story of the Titanic. And you know, which is not maybe a subject that would seem like it would immediately lend itself to musicalization. But in the first act, I don't think there's a misstep, really. It's just everything seems natural, and there are musical moments when there should be, and dialogue scenes when there should be, and blah, blah, blah. In Act Two, I think far, far less success from both men. It just almost falls apart, especially the music. There seems to be no inspiration for most of it, with three major exceptions. At the very end of the second act, we have a reprise of the magnificent theme, Godspeed Titanic, which is as powerful when we hear it at the end, or even more so than when we hear it at the beginning. There's also the duet between the Strausses, which I find very lovely and very moving. And oddly enough, a moment that you would think would have been the most difficult to musicalize. Right before the ship goes down, Thomas Andrews, who the architect who built the ship, is obsessively going through the plans and saying, oh, well, if we had just made these walls higher and extended this to there, then we wouldn't be sinking. And then he starts envisioning what the final moments of the ship are going to be and how horrific that's going to be, with people clinging to the small section of the ship that still hasn't sunk yet, and like bees to a hive, he says, or sings. And that, I think, is like absolutely brilliant, that whole section that he sings there, and very, I would have thought, very difficult to write. But much of the other stuff in Act Two, to me, is just does not make it. But ironically, the thing is that the story, of course, is still moving forward, and the story of what is about to happen to all these people is so gripping and compelling that it almost doesn't matter that the music is not very good at all. So I think that that accounts for the fact that many people are not tending to focus on how uninspired the music is in the second act, because they're too busy responding to the story, which is so, to this day, is so chilling and so horrifying and so moving. Anyway, so that's the show. This production, I mean, it was the high school production, so I won't give a out and out review, but I did want to mention the names of several very, very talented young people in key roles here. There are not that many, but there are several key roles in Titanic where I think you do have an opportunity to shine and show your abilities as an actor, singer. And so let me give a shout out to Sammy Dale as Thomas Andrews, Oscar Sutton. All right, let me get this right, because it's not hard, but it's several syllables. Oscar Saltalamacchia as Frederick Barrett. Zell Steele Morrow as Harold Bride, the wireless operator. Chance K. Smith as First Officer Murdoch. He doesn't sing much as that character, but when he first opened his mouth to sing, I was like, wow, this guy is going to go somewhere. Josh Masonet as the bellboy. I was very happy that they cast a boy as the bellboy, rather than what happened in the original Broadway production, was that it was an adult woman, and it was the most annoying thing that kept happening, and I just wanted it to stop. And then I hadn't mentioned, when I saw it, the show at NYU a couple of weeks ago, they also had a girl in it, and I thought, well, why didn't they just find a freshman boy to do it? So anyway, I don't see the point of gender blind casting there. Josh Masonet as bellboy / second class passenger. And who else? Rosabella Procario Soler as Alice Bean. That's the Victoria Clark role from the original production. And she has a very meaty role, and she did a wonderful job with it. This is another case where the orchestra, although presumably all students, sounded magnificent, and it was about, I just counted, and I think it was about 20 in the orchestra. Some unfortunate technical snafus, but nothing that ruined the production. And it was, aside from everything else, since it was a school production, obviously they had no limit on the number of people on stage, other than, you know, whatever the stage could hold. So I would say, for example, that in the chorales, in the first and second act, the Godspeed Titanic chorales, I would not be surprised if there were twice as many people on stage as were on Broadway for those numbers. And the sound was absolutely thrilling. And I probably don't have to tell you that, because this was a high school and the audience was made up of mostly of parents and friends and family members, that every number got a tremendous ovation. And I was really glad to be there. I only found out about this recently, and I just walked over and bought a ticket for $25, and I loved every minute of it.
Mm-hmm. That's wonderful. I don't know really anything about the Professional Performing Arts School, but I was going quickly through their website. It's a New York City high school. It's like,
yep.
That's really wonderful that, you know, students can, you know, get to it. The New York City high school system is fascinating. It's really a dichotomy of highs and lows, of really just amazing opportunities and amazing disasters. So,
well, I'm sure I mentioned this before. I had been there before because there was a teacher there, and I'm sorry, I don't remember his name. I should have looked it up. Who was kind of famously bringing major names from Broadway in to speak to the students on various subjects. And the day I went, it was Lin-Manuel Miranda who came in to explain in detail how he was translating the lyrics of West Side Story into Spanish. So I got to sit there with those, 13-year-olds and watch Lin-Manuel Miranda do that. So that was a highlight of my life, let me tell you.
Do you know him?
Lin?
Yeah.
A little.
And did you know him then?
I mean, I knew him to the extent that I guess I had interviewed him for Heights several times.
I wonder if he thought that you were this very stupid student who had to repeat the grade over and over and over. That's why I'm asking.
No, I think he knew me enough to know that I was not. I had not been left back five times. Okay. That's what you say.
I was just talking with my daughter about Lin yesterday. It's so funny because I'm rewatching the television show House, which is I don't know if you know House with Hugh Laurie, lots of other various Broadway folks have appeared on House, but Lin was in a few episodes of House, my daughter walked in while Lin was on the TV and she says, "Oh my God, that's Lin." And I was like, "Yeah." I was like, he's done a lot of stuff before Hamilton, All right. So that's the Professional Performing Arts School production of Titanic. Unfortunately, they had a short run and it has passed, but I'll have a link to the high school in the show notes if you want to check it out. They also have a great Instagram page where they have great photographs from rehearsal and the production and the various cast members. So that's in the show notes as well.
And as may have been mentioned, if you you won't be able to see this production, but if you really want to see Titanic, you won't have to wait too long because it's going to be done by City Center Encores.
So, Peter, what do you know about corruption?
I'm glad I know that it's playing at the Newhouse Theater in Lincoln Center because it's really a tremendous effort. This is based on the book Dial M for Murdoch, News Corporation and the Corruption of Britain by Tom Watson and Martin Hickman. Tom Watson, indeed, was the British Labour Party leader back then in 2010, 2011, when this all was broke. And he was treated very badly in the press by a Rupert Murdoch publication. And Rebecca Brooks, the editor-in-chief of the Rag, the tabloid. There is a statement made that tabloids sell better than broadsheets, and that's kind of interesting as well. But anyway, Tom Watson would take his life down, and as a result, he fought it. And so here we have a David against Goliath type of thing going on. What really gets fascinating is the second act, because indeed we find out that something that Tom Watson expected to be true, believed to be true, is not true. And this is the thing that he was really, really, really going to nab them on, that he was really going to put them in a legal corner from which they couldn't extricate themselves. And then he finds out the information he has is not at all true. Not at all. And what does he do? Does the end justify the means? The idea that he would take these people down more important than the fact that he would do it with information that is not indeed correct? So corruption works both ways, and that's what's really fascinating in the play by J.T. Rogers, who wrote Oslo, which was at Lincoln Center some years ago and was very, very powerful. So a tremendous production by Bartlett Sher. There is virtually no set. There are tables that are moved around incessantly, making different configurations, but it must have been very, very hard to direct this show, even in terms of being a traffic cop and putting various tables in various places and making it all work. The thought that must have gone into that is mind-blowing. But anyway, Toby Stevens plays Tom Watson very, very well. Saffron Burrows plays Rebecca Brooks very, very well. And yet, I also want to give a shout out to Dylan Baker, who I've seen so many times and giving so many wonderful performances along the way. But here he has to play a British gentleman, and he does it phenomenally well. He really seems genuinely British. And what's even more fascinating is later he comes back in a completely different role that he's almost unrecognizable, almost. Is that Dylan? Yes, it is. Oh, wow. Playing somebody from a completely different walk of life, and he does that very effectively as well. Now, he is certainly not the only person to double, because even though there are about a dozen people in the cast, they play close to 50 roles. I mean, Tom Watson and Rebecca Brooks are played by one and only one performer, but everybody else must double like crazy, triple, quadruple, because Martin Hickman actually is a character as well, but he also plays Colin Myler, a Welsh MP, a male newscaster, and a car repair shop owner. I'm telling you, this show goes all over the place, and but it seems a little confusing at the beginning, but you may feel yourself a little bit lost. It does take a while, especially if you don't know the story. And I don't know who does and who doesn't, because this was a big deal at the time, but 13 years have passed, so I don't know if people remember it or remember it well. But you have to catch up to it. But once you catch up to it, you're very glad you took the ride with it. So, a tremendous production, and it's very nice to see Lincoln Center in the Newhouse Theater having something that's so powerful.
All right. So that's Corruption at Lincoln Center Theater's Mitzi Newhouse. We'll have a link to that in the show notes. It's playing through April 14th. All right. So in the news this week, we had two unexpected announcements that Spamalot and Days of Wine and Roses are going to be closing earlier than expected in their original runs on Broadway. Peter Michael, any thoughts about this?
Wasn't Spamalot always limited engagement?
Yeah.
They
So with
both
dates,
were.
both were limited engagements. Spamalot, I think, was originally scheduled through August or so, and Days of Wine and
Was it?
Roses
Okay.
through beginning of June. And the surprising part is that announcing these closings before the nominations, I don't know if that's strategic. The whole thing of announcing a closing bump in sales extends it a little bit. Maybe they can get to the nominations. If they get some nominations, maybe extends a little bit more. I don't know if they really closed just the window of ticketing, or if this is strategic or financially necessary, but
I would say if Days of Wine and Roses lasted a third as long as it has, that Brian D'Arcy James and Kelly O'Hara would have no problem getting nominations. So at least that, they're definitely going to be remembered. They're extraordinary.
It's just
More the show itself,
And do they get they get the nominators in, but do they get the whole Tony voters in?
Yeah, that's another story, of course.
A lot of Tony voters are out of town and strategically schedule when they can get to town to see a
That's right.
show.
Which is a bug in the system, I'm sorry to say. In terms of Spamalot, I fully expected. Fully expect that Michael Urie and Leslie Kritzer will be remembered. So, but who knows? Nobody knows anything.
That's true. So, if these are on your list of, I didn't get around to it to see it, you got to move that list up sooner. Talk to Cheryl Hodges Selden to book your tickets. She seems to know how to get in and out of town. Four years ago, we were talking about, well, maybe Broadway will close for a week or 2 weeks. So, and then it came 18 months later, we finally reopened Broadway, but COVID is not gone. We haven't really seen an official press release about this, but various shows still get canceled at the last minute. Peter and Michael were canceled at the last minute for Teeth. Mm-hmm. We think that was not COVID related, but certainly COVID seems to have given shows more permission to cancel at the last minute, or am I making that up?
Seems like.
It does. Yeah.
Yeah. Probably. So things you have to be careful about. Especially, I feel bad for out-of-towners who get canceled at the last minute, who've spent thousands of dollars to get to New York. And I'm not blaming the shows. You got to do what you got to do.
No.
Yeah.
Also, this might be a good time for me to bring up some friends of mine and I have noticed that there seems to be a general movement towards not treating the audience very well. As opposed to in the past. And here's a specific example that I didn't mention. We discussed the 7-year Disappear last year, Peter, when you weren't here. We said positive and negative things about the show. But what I didn't mention was that this show is at the Pershing Square Signature Center, which has 3 or 4 theaters in it, small theaters in it. And so people were gathered to go into the theater to see the 7-year Disappear. And I don't actually remember the curtain time, but let's say it was 7 p.m. Mm-hmm. And people were gathered and people were gathered and people were waiting and nothing was happening and the house was not opening. And at about 10 of, I went to the person who was sitting there at the door, and I said, "Why is the house opening so late?" And he said, "Oh, it'll be opening any minute, and it will get everyone in really quickly." The house opened 2 minutes before the show was scheduled to begin. And when I asked the person again, I said, "Why? What is the purpose of this? Is something wrong in there? Is there a technical problem?" He said, "No, the show is immersive. And the show starts as soon as you enter the theater." I said, "Okay. Do you know what they meant by immersive?" Cynthia Nixon Taylor Trench were sitting on stage facing each other.
Right.
And saying nothing.
Yeah.
So, I'm very down on that theater anyway, the new group and its director. But to me, it's just like, so you have to be so pretentious. I mean, well, first of all, why couldn't they have been sitting there earlier? And if you don't want to have them sitting there earlier, Cynthia Nixon and Taylor Trench, then don't just let people in anyway. It's just very, very inconsiderate. And I think sometimes people let their pretensions get in the way of treating people well. Mm.
On the flip side of it, the immersive thing, we had announcements about this revival of Cabaret. I think the house is going to open an hour and a half early.
Yes,
isn't it? Or something like that? You know?
Yes, as we mentioned. And apparently they have a separate little company of performers who are going to be only in the pre-show.
Pre-show.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah. Mm. So there are ways to do it, but they did not figure out. I don't know what they were doing there. And it just didn't seem that there was anything to them, that there was anything wrong with not letting the audience in until 2 minutes before the scheduled showtime. But I just.
Perhaps they're not letting people into the shows because they want to keep them outside to watch the lights dim.
I thought you were going to say concessions. But they
the concessions
money.
Too. Yeah. If they could charge for the lights dimming, they would. So this Tuesday coming up, we have March 12th. The Committee of Theater Owners are going to dim all the lights in the Broadway theaters for exactly 1 minute at 6:45 p.m. to honor Hinton Battle, who passed away. And so this is a great honor for somebody who you know, again, how do you imagine a Broadway without Hinton Battle? He's just always been there for me.
Well, there are very few people who can say they won a Tony Award for each time they were nominated. And Hinton Battle is one of them. So three Tony Awards, that's pretty good. You know, and even though we hadn't seen him for a long, long time, that achievement cannot be denied. I have to say that his big break that came in The Wiz was something I did not see, because I was at the very, 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 very first performance of The Wiz in Baltimore. I think it was October 20th, 1974. And Stu Gillum, a TV comedian, was playing the role at that point in time. And I've heard so many conflicting stories that he quit because he said the show will never go anywhere, a very bad prediction as it turned out, or that they amiably parted company. I've heard that as well. But anyway, I think Hinton Battle was 17 years old at the time and got the part of the Scarecrow, and obviously he did well by it. But that was not one of his Tony wins. You've got to be impressed by somebody who gets nominated and wins each and every time.
Yeah. So that wraps it up for this week. Before we get on to the brain teaser and the musical moments, I want to remind everybody that you can subscribe to these broadcasts by going to the front page of BroadwayRadio.com. There's a subscribe link. That way, each and every time we have a new episode of This Week on Broadway, we download it to Apple Podcasts for you. I don't know how many of you guys listen to it in Apple Podcasts, but Apple Podcasts just added a transcript feature where the transcript is automatically generated and you can read along as you're listening or refer back to something. Again, you know, with automated transcripts, it's not 100% perfect, but it's pretty cool. And I hope that all the other services get it. But right now, it seems to be just Apple Podcasts. You can also get us on Patreon, patreon.com/Broadway Radio. And if you subscribe there, you get our podcasts early, plus you get extra bonus feature content, and you will also be able to support all the rest of the Broadway Radio shows. You can listen to us on Spotify, iHeartRadio, TuneIn, Stitcher, Pandora, Google Play, YouTube Music, all anywhere that you can listen to find our podcasts, you'll find Broadway Radio's offerings. Contact information for Peter, for Michael, and for me can be found in the show notes at BroadwayRadio.com, as well as links to some of the things we've talked about today. So, Peter, do you have an answer to last week's brain teaser?
Some musical get unfortunate nicknames. The Red Shoes, with Julie Stein's final score, was known as Julie's Last Jam. Such spoofy nicknames are usually reserved for big flops, but there's one that was foisted upon a successful production. That nickname just happens to be the actual name of a 1940s film that was based on a story with a different title and whose hero was a famous fictional lawyer who would later be seen as the title character in three different TV series. Well, Earl Stanley Gardner wrote about Perry Mason, who would eventually get three TV series, in The Case of the Dangerous Dowager. It became the 1940 film Granny, Get Your Gun. That's what many people called the 1966 hit revival of Annie, Get Your Gun, when 58-year-old Ethel Merman co-starred with 30-year-old Bruce Yarnell. Tony Janicki vaulted back into first place, followed by Paul Witte, Deb Popple, Arthur Robinson, not to be confused with David Robinson, who got it too. So did Sean Logan, Rob Johnston, T.J. Lancaster, Brigadoon, and Jack Lester. Excuse me, Jack Leshner. This week's question. First play, A Fact Can Be a Beautiful Thing, on the 1968 original Broadway cast album of Promises, Promises, right to the end. Then play the first minute of the overture of the 1963 musical, Here's Love. After you've experienced both, the name of what musical will come to mind? Now, here's a hint. It was produced in a season that also saw one of those two musicals I named above.
If you have an answer for that, email us at trivia@BroadwayRadio.com. We'll let you know if you're on the right track. So, Michael, what do we have in this week's musical moments?
We have a tribute to Steve Lawrence, who has died. We were just talking about him recently because the Lawrence Family Foundation had given a huge amount of money to Carnegie Hall. And then also coming up at Zankel Hall at Carnegie Hall is going to be a toast to Steve and Edie. This will be on Monday, the 18th of March at 8 p.m. And that will be the singers will be David Lawrence, son of Steve and Edie Gourmet, and Debbie Gravett, who has already played and sung the role of Edie Gourmet in several things. So I know that's going to be a very special thing. But Steve and Edie were quite popular in their day. They were on TV constantly. They had lots of recordings, several albums. And in addition to that, Steve made a name for himself as a sketch comedian on the Carol Burnett Show. She had him on a lot because he really was very, very, very good at that. And then aside from all that, all their club work, their constant club work, their TV work, Steve was in two Broadway shows. One was called What Makes Sammy Run. And then the other show in which he appeared with Edie, it was called Golden Rainbow. So we're giving you two selections, one each from those two shows today. Our opener is A Room Without Windows from What Makes Sammy Run, a song that became a hit to a certain degree. Yeah. And the second one is the title song from Golden Rainbow, which features well, in this recording, it's just Steve, but Steve and Edie had recorded it as well separately. So it's we say this a lot. It's the end of an era. This is the end of an era of those types of performers, as far as I can tell. They were really very, very much of their time, and people loved them for the style of performances that they did. So someone mentioned to me today that they were considered the last of the tux and gown performers. I mean, maybe not the very last, but close. Just it's a whole different mode of presentation now. And the presentation as well as the material, of course, that we see, that we hear when people perform on TV and in clubs and things like that. So, that this is presented with great affection for both Steve Lawrence and Edie Gourmet.
Well, I saw What Makes Sammy Run, and it was part of that great parade season. And I remember at the time, producer Joseph Cates took a lot of heat for casting Steve Lawrence in this role. After all, he had not been on Broadway before. Sure, he could sing, but this was a very demanding role because Sammy Glick, the character he plays, is a terrible human being. I mean, he will do anything to get ahead. And Cates, I remember saying to me, yeah, but I thought I'd get somebody likable and that would help a great deal. And Steve Lawrence was very likable. Hmm. And he was terrific in the show, both as a singer and an actor. And he had, as I say, a lot of unpleasant things to do in the show. And he did get a Tony nomination. And that year, the Tony went to Bert Lahr for a musical called Foxy, which didn't run along period of time, and a lot of people felt it was a lifetime achievement type of Tony that sometimes people get because they've been around so long and they've done such wonderful work in the past, and they've not had enough of a chance to get a Tony, especially Bert Lahr's career, who his career was certainly well on its way long before the Tonys came into being. So this was a way of awarding him. But for a tough show like What Makes Sammy Run, a lot of people felt that the reason it ran 540 performances had a lot to do with Steve Lawrence. And in fact, to be perfectly fair, he did take off during the Christmas week, which was highly criticized because that, of course, is the biggest week of the year. And he didn't want to continue with the show. And Paul Anka, of all people, came in for 1 week when he had a vacation. But it was really considered that he was irreplaceable. And as a result, the show closed when he wanted it to close, in essence. But when he was there, whoa, was he really a powerhouse in a very, very hard part.
Yeah.
Jason Robert Brown wrote a really nice remembrance of Steve Lawrence on Facebook, and I'll leave that in the show notes for anybody who'd like to check it out. So we'll put a link in the show notes about it. All right. So on behalf of Michael Portantier and Peter Felicia, this is James Marino saying thanks so much for listening to Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway. Bye-bye.
Rainbow, make me lucky. Make my golden dream come true. Break the clouds and bring me sunshine. I'm depending on you. I'll never ask again if you give me this one thing. I want no more if you give me this dream. One little turn of luck and I'll really be something. I want it, I need it, I'm asking, I'm begging, please. Golden rainbow, come up shining. Bring me fortune, you know how. If you're ever gonna touch me, golden rainbow.